Monday, June 16th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
A lot of news happened over the past few days, Avi. There were massive No Kings protests over the weekend in 2,000-plus locations across the country. Philadelphia was the epicenter of that. Tens of thousands of people showed up. Meanwhile, tens of thousands danced in the streets. There was a military parade that rolled through Washington, D.C., marking the Army's 250th anniversary. It was also President Trump's 79th birthday. And who can ignore the violent attacks on two Minnesota lawmakers that took place? A lot has happened, right? And so today we're going to talk about all of it. We have a political roundtable. We have two columnists with very differing viewpoints who are going to help us sort through this and give their thoughts on what's happening. And so we want to hear your thoughts as well. So our question of today is this: what do you think is the most significant news story of the last week? Tell us what you think stood out to you, how you feel about it. You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, leave those comments in the chat. I posted something on Facebook, and pretty quickly, a lot of comments came in.
Yeah, it was a busy week, a busy weekend, and it feels like a very tense moment in America. I think you could say that about past weekends and past months and past years, but right now, the last 7 days or so does feel like a moment. And we want to hear from you. This is really an open show.
This is your
what's
chance.
On your mind? And also, in part, what do you think of all the things that happened over the last week or so? What do you think we'll still be thinking about in a year or even 10 years? So again, that number, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Yeah. And a trio of local news stories to kick us off, Cherry. And I believe you are going to tell us about the first story today.
Yes, a number of Philadelphia area immigrants received a sharply worded text telling them to report to ICE on Father's Day, which was Sunday. Yesterday, right? It's unclear how many people got the messages on Friday, but it was received either via text or an app telling the individuals to show up at 8th and Art Street between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Sunday. And it included in that message a line that said, quote, failure to report as instructed will be considered a violation. So, of course, this scared people. And some of the folks who showed up on Sunday were asylum seekers. Some had deportation orders already outstanding against them, and others had their paperwork straight. They were working to get green cards. Keisha Hudson, who runs the Defender Association of Philadelphia, spoke to the Inquirer. She said her organization represents two people who got that message. They asked to have that meeting that was on Sunday rescheduled. That was denied. And what happened once people got there varied depending on, you know, who they were. Some, you know, there were people who were definitely taken into custody. Their families were told that they would be deported. Other folks just had their paperwork checked and they were allowed to leave. The Philadelphia Inquirer did a whole piece on this, spoke to people from all over the region who had this. And lawyers, they were thinking, they're like, why would you hold this on a Sunday with the short notice, knowing that people may not be able to get legal representation to show up, especially on Father's Day?
Yeah, and I'll shout out again that piece in the Inquirer. It's not a long piece. It doesn't take long to read, but it's really an incredible example of quick turn reporting, a small story that captures what seems to be a big trend, this sort of bureaucratic terror that ICE has unleashed. And I think the vision we have in our mind of immigration enforcement is things we see on social media, a sweep, a raid, some sort of physical thing that you can capture on video that exists in the world. But a lot of what we've heard about is more stuff along this line where people are being summoned. They don't know why. It's short notice. We reported on those mass emails people received to self-deport. Someone even went to immigration attorneys, and oddly enough. So I think in a lot of cases, it more looks like this, even though that's not something you can capture as easily in a social media post.
And the thing is, you don't even know if this is real. You know, you're getting a text message. You don't know who it's from. And you're scared not to show up when you see that line. So there's just so much going on. And this was real. Although, you know, the Inquirer did reach out to the Department of Homeland Security did not get a response. But this is, I mean, this is becoming very scary and very real for so many people.
Yeah. Another story in the Inquirer that caught our eye was about the Bok Building.
Yeah.
So if you don't know the Bok Building, if you don't live in South Philly, it's a really fascinating site. Over the last dozen years or so, South Philadelphia's Bok Building has undergone a stunning transformation. It used to be a technical high school, and now it's this huge 9-story community hub with eateries, lots of artist studios, nonprofits, even a very popular rooftop bar. Great views up there.
Yeah.
Top
of
the
nice.
Bok Building. Mm-hmm. But this story in the Inquirer asks whether Bok could become a model for readapting other large Philadelphia buildings. And they say other developers are thinking about copying the Bok model in neighborhoods such as Germantown and the Navy Yard. So could there be little Bok, baby Bok, other Bok all across Philadelphia? Something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I thought another great story in the Inquirer today. They looked at the U Arts building right on South Broad Street. I've been in that building for some events. It's a great building. And what makes the Bok building so great, and I went there for a photo shoot one time, and it was, and I wandered around because that's what journalists do. We get very nosy.
You were
and
nosy,
start,
yeah.
You know, looking around things. And I wonder, though, the U Arts building, I wonder if that can be duplicated just because of the price of real estate these days. You know, they talked about the U Arts building, how it's a third of the size of the Bok building, but is going to be purchased for a significantly higher fee. And you wonder how a building like that can be kept at an accessible price for the types of artists and small businesses that would, you know, serve as residents of a building.
Well, it would
like
have
that.
To be a different type of tenant for sure. I mean, part of it is that they mentioned that building.
And that's but that's what makes Bok cool, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
It's lots of little businesses. It's people that otherwise couldn't afford a storefront or a space. Sometimes they share space. I mean, it's really a remarkable building. The breadth of artisans within that 9 stories is unbelievable. But they mentioned that one on South Broad Street because it's owned by the same developer. She bought it. I would have to imagine it's going to be a somewhat different concept.
Yeah, it has to be. Yeah.
It's also a much more central location. So real estate's always more expensive. It's very close to City Hall. Bok Building is deeper in South Philly. But it's an interesting concept for me because, you know, I had read so many stories about how the co-working spaces were falling on hard times. People didn't want, you know, in-person spaces anymore. And maybe the truth is more that people wanted different types of spaces, not necessarily a big room where everyone sits, you know,
and with a laptop.
Space.
Yeah.
Yeah. But more, you know, you have your own. Basically, everyone has their own classroom in Bok to run their own business, former classroom. And it's a fascinating idea. So I'll be watching this with great interest.
Yeah, for sure.
Story number 3, Cherry. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia Magazine has a story about a membership-only fried chicken club.
Fried chicken.
In Ambler. You might be thinking, what? Well, I'm going to explain. The club is called Mary's Chicken Strip Club. It's a pop-up that sells fried chicken sandwiches and chicken strips every Sunday. But here's the catch. Mm-hmm. You have to be a member of the club if you want the privilege of paying for one of those delicious sandwiches. There are only 100 memberships. I think they made them available like a few weeks ago.
Gone.
They cost $50 a year, and they're sold out. 100 people. And there's already a waiting list, apparently, to be a part of Mary's Chicken Strip Club. And these dining clubs have become a bit of a thing. There's one in South Philadelphia called the Polizzi Social Club. It's like a restaurant inside a row home. You have to be a member to get a table type of thing. But this was a first for me, a membership-only fried chicken club. And I know you've got thoughts. I can just see it on your face.
So, you know I love fried chicken. And I know you love fried chicken.
Sure.
And so to me, I was like, well, what's up with this fried chicken getting everybody so hot and bothered? Well, according to, hot and bothered. They're selling out, you know, memberships, $50, you know. According to Jason Cohen of Philly Mag, who wrote this story, apparently the recipe was based on Thomas Keller's ad hoc. It had lemon, garlic, and fresh herb brine plus seasoned flour. But then they added smoked paprika. And that's what made everybody go crazy. Okay. And so now you know, people are running out to get this chicken. So I'm wondering, like, why are people snapping this up? It must be deliciousness.
Or it's the perception of scarcity created by the club model, right?
It could be that.
So you can't get it. You're curious.
I was like, this chicken must be
But you
good,
can't
delicious.
Get it. You can't get the chicken.
It's exclusive.
Right.
And thereby,
yes,
people want it.
Yes.
I want these chicken
this
strips.
This is human psychology.
Some crinkly fries.
Also, they have crinkle fries. Shout out to crinkle fries, by the way. Those are like the cafeteria fries you had as a kid, and they're so underrated. So I will say,
I like a crinkly
shout
fry.
Out to crinkle fries.
Crinkle.
On Not the other crinkly. Side of this break, we're going to talk about just everything happening in the world. That's it on Studio 2, coming back after this break.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to WHYY's Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Usually we focus our show on one topic, but today, after a whirlwind weekend of news headlines, we wanted to take a broader view. There's a lot on our minds, from militarization in Los Angeles to assassination in Minnesota to demonstration across the country. And we're going to discuss it all this hour with a panel of pundits.
Christine Flowers is a lawyer and columnist. Christine, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hi, Avi. Hi, Cherry. Great to be back.
Always great to have you. Same to Solomon Jones, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist and WURD radio host. Solomon, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And our question for you this hour, what do you think is the most significant news story of the last week and why? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube. Drop a comment right there in the chat.
And so I wanted to just pose that question that we're posing to our audience, to you, Solomon, and to you, Christine. What story is sort of standing out to you that you think we'll be talking about for a long time to come? Solomon, we'll start with you.
I think the protests are probably the biggest story, because they're a reflection of where people are in this moment. Where will people be in 2026 when the midterms come around? It's great to protest in the streets. You need to protest in the voting booth. And so what is going to happen with these protests? I think when you compare them to what happened after the first Trump election in 2017, where you had the Women's March, and then it didn't really make a difference in the voting booth. I'm curious as to see what these protests will do in terms of the outcomes in the next election.
So this knows Kings, will it have staying power? We'll see. Christine, your thoughts.
You know, to an extent, I agree with Solomon, and I do believe that the protests are extremely important. But with the assassination of the Minnesota lawmakers, and it brings home the idea of passion, and can that passion be channeled in a constructive way, as I believe was done with most of the protests this weekend, or does it take a toxic form and it manifests itself in violence? And so I think that we do have, Solomon saying that this is right, that this will have an impact on the midterms, but I see a ratcheting up of passion, whether it be dedication to bettering society or simply nihilism, as in the individual who killed Representative Horstman and her husband. It's just, you know,
a tragic moment.
It is.
Yeah, and we'll just underline or underscore that Vance Belter is 57, arrested and in custody, charged with murder in the death of Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark. Also accused of wounding State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. And it is reported that he had a list of 70 targets, though very early in that investigation still, and we should underline that as well. Speaking of No Kings, though, that's the one that's closest to home for many people. And I'm curious, by the way, if anyone out there was part of the protest on Saturday and can give us some on-the-ground perspective. So give us a call if that's you. But Edie commented and said, no kings made my hippie heart happy. John said protests are useless unless they translate to a crushing defeat for the GOP in the midterms. So let's talk about where the sort of the Trump resistance is now compared to where it was Trump 1.0 about 5 months in. I think actually if you look at the numbers and the data, Solomon, there's been more people protesting actually in these first 5 months than even those first 5 months.
Yeah.
So just on the numbers, that backlash seems pretty strong. Does that mean anything to you?
I'm not going to know until the midterms. I'm not going to, because...
Does it feel different to you?
It feels different, but it feels different because of what people are protesting against. Mm-hmm. In the first Trump term, I don't think President Trump understood what could be done, what couldn't be done, what the guardrails were, etc. In this second term, they came out with a 900-page plan called Project 2025 that they are following pretty closely. And the executive orders are coming hot and heavy.
Yep.
They are pre-written. They are ready to be done. And they're gumming up the works. Christine, you're a lawyer. You know that the courts move slowly. And they are scrambling to handle these lawsuits that are being filed against these different actions that are being taken. So I think this time around, because the Trump administration knows better how things work in Washington, how things work in the federal government, they've been able to do more and do it more quickly, and people are responding to that.
Let me see if I can maybe summarize that and kick this to Christine. It seems to me the protests at this stage during Trump 1.0 were protests to the idea that someone like Donald Trump could be elected president in America. This time, from what I hear you say, Solomon, it feels more like it's a protest against things that he has done as president. And I wonder if that's a more potent force. Christine, do you agree with that synopsis? And do you think it is indeed potentially a more powerful political movement because of that?
I absolutely do. I think that's a great distillation, Avi. And to Solomon's point, he is absolutely correct that the Trump administration now understands better than it did in the first 4 years how to maneuver, how to thread the needles and to get things done. However, so do lawyers. Lawyers know how to push back. And there have been so many lawsuits against his initiatives. So I think, and in fact, I posted on Facebook, I'm not going to a No Kings protest. I'm going to my office today because I have lawsuits to file for my clients. And I think what you said is absolutely correct. People are now motivated, animated by what they see happening now in the streets, as opposed to the theory of, well, they're going to take away our reproductive rights. That was done. Yeah. Or they're going to arrest my father and deport him. That is being done. So I think that it's actually more powerful now. Although, to the point that one of your listeners wrote, protests are only as effective as the polls, only as effective as getting people out to vote and make change and not just march for change. Mm.
By the way, I want to read some of the comments that came in to our reporters. Some marchers were first-time protesters, even former Trump voters or like people who voted for Trump just this last election. Others were veterans and scientists. And one protester who voted for Trump in 2024 explained why he was out there. He said, first it's the Latinos, then it's the gays, then it's the blacks. They're coming for everybody. I want to sort of get your thoughts on why you think there's such a broad coalition. And I was actually shocked to see so many people who voted for Trump just a few moments, you know, a few months ago, sort of switching and now taking part in the No Kings protest. Your thoughts on that part?
So I think that the coalition is broad, but not as broad as it could be, because I think that there are some voters who felt betrayed. I think the black community is really taking a wait and see approach in terms of protesting. I wrote an article that a lot of people got angry about.
I was going to bring this up, right? Because
a lot of black folks are, you do not see as many black folks out at these types of No Kings. Go ahead.
Because around 86% of black voters voted against Donald Trump. He got more of a segment of the black electorate than he did before. But certainly the vast majority of black people voted against Donald Trump. And felt betrayed by others who said they were in coalition with us prior to this election, who, when we looked at the numbers, were not. Mm-hmm. And so black folks, by and large, are staying home from these protests and believe that, you know, we'll show us the money. Show us what happens when it's time to vote. Show us what happens when it's really time to make your voice heard in a way that matters in terms of the outcomes. And so I think that people are upset because they see what is happening. They see that it is true. But I also think that people who voted for Trump thought that he was coming for everybody else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what they now realize is that, no, he was coming for me, too. I just believed the rhetoric, and now I understand the reality.
And I want you to chime in there, Christine, because this Trump supporter actually was shocked, and you've been seeing these stories sort of bubble up in the media where people who voted for Trump just a few months ago were shocked that the immigration policies, you know, amplified and ramped up in such a way that affected people in their lives. They thought that it would not go there. Your thoughts on sort of this realization, this dawn of realization that are coming over folks?
It's absolutely true. And I almost want to say to them, you know, Maya Angelou, when people tell you who they are, believe them. Why did you not believe that this was going to happen? Because
well,
this
they're probably
was
thinking about Trump 1.0, though.
Yeah.
Because the rhetoric wasn't that different. And then he got in there.
He did
like a tax cut, basically, and then kind of just spent the rest of the time seemingly tweeting. I mean, I'm not saying that was all it was, but it was not quite like if you looked at immigration enforcement the 4 years before and then during his four years and then Biden, was it all that different?
Well, I think during the campaign, immigration became
the big issue. Yeah.
I noticed, I mean, and it's not just me because I have the immigration antenna up, but I noticed a change in the language. And Solomon and I were talking before we came on air, and we were talking about, I mentioned a woman that I saw interviewed in South Florida whose husband had just been picked up and deported, and she had voted for Trump. And they asked her, they said, why did you vote for Trump? She said, he said he was going to deport the criminals. My husband's not a criminal. Mm-hmm. And I think to myself, either he had a great messaging, you know, he was able to sort of target or double speak, you know, say what the buzzwords, yeah, that people mm-hmm. would hear, but the larger population that wasn't paying close enough attention to the immigration message just really did think that he was going to go after the bad guys,
yeah,
you know, the rapists and the murderers that mm-hmm. he talked about when he was campaigning the first time around.
And you think about it because I think folks who are more skilled in understanding political messaging heard mass deportation, you know, effort ever. That's what they kind of heard. By the way, we have a caller. Gary from Mount Airy was at the protest over the weekend, is on the line. Gary, you're on Studio 2. What's your comment? What was it like out there?
Well, it was great seeing, you know, 80,000 people, but I just want to I'm a nonviolent resistance scientist and inventor, and I've been an organizer for over 45 years. And I want to remind people that the research clearly proves, and this is by our own George Lakey, Erica Chenoweth, Gene Sharp, that protests are totally insufficient to overthrow fascist regimes. And not only that, but no major advance in American history since the Civil War, whether it's human rights, labor rights, democracy rights in America, has ever happened without massive nonviolent resistance. And the same thing with electoral strategy. It's absolutely essential, but it's also been absolutely insufficient without massive nonviolent resistance. And the danger of protests is that people feel they've done their part. They're off the hook. They don't have to do anything more. So when I was there, I signed up 25 people per hour wanting to get a document listing 23 much more effective tactics for overthrowing fascist regimes and saving the planet.
Mm. Thanks. That's Gary from Mount Airy. Amy on YouTube says, I was glad to be at the Philly No Kings March, but the crowd skewed older. Mm. I'm 61, saw many of my mother and mother-in-law's friends, some of my husband and my friends, none of my kids' friends.
Wow.
That's an interesting observation from mm-hmm. Amy, as well as Gary at Mount Airy. So we've been talking about this sort of theoretical, I don't want to say theoretical, but there are people that really exist who've soured on Trump over the last 5 months. That said, the polling overall hasn't mm-hmm. changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. And now we are now into, you know, a decade basically of Trump as this figure, and the polls never seem to change all that much on him. Do either of you think the immigration enforcement issue because it's more visceral, because it's real, because the impact is more personal. Do you think this is the topic where, or the issue where he could push it too far in a way that actually incurs a steep electoral cost?
No.
You say no, Solomon.
No, because again, people are concerned with what affects them. Until it affects people personally, I don't think people will be appalled.
Yep.
They'll be shocked. They'll be maybe even angry. But I don't know that will move numbers in terms of what happens in the polls and what happens in the ultimate poll on election day. I do think if there were an issue that might move numbers, for me, it's Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Because Medicaid runs whole hospitals in rural areas. And also, of course, you know, you've got millions and millions of individuals who are going to lose their health coverage. So people care about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about things that don't affect them. And until it does, people will poo-poo it. But I don't know that it changes the numbers.
And it could take a while for that.
What do you think, Christine, on that? There is this question of just in general, because Trump just seems to block out the idea that people might disagree with him. He just sort of charges forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this eternal question of, does he finally charge forward into an issue where he gets stuck and there's really no political escape from it? Do you think that's this issue? Is it another issue? Where do you lie?
Well, you know, I both agree and I disagree with my beloved Solomon over here. I agree that people are moved by the things that impact them personally.
Mm-hmm.
So you go out and you protest and you march and you write letters and mm-hmm. you do your things when it touches you personally. I disagree that immigration is not that sort of an issue because, you know, we only see the tip of the iceberg when mm-hmm. we're talking about criminal aliens. Most of the people in society that are immigrants, undocumented, have an attachment at either one or two spaces removed to a U.S. citizen. They're married. That's their father. They have children.
Co-worker.
And it is
employee.
Employee mm-hmm. and employee. And it's mm-hmm. increasing and it's increasing. So it's hitting both your personal life, your economic welfare. And I see that burgeoning right now. And I really do think that the violence that is being done with the immigration policies from this administration right now are going to have an impact. And they're going to have an impact on people who may not, excuse me, even have immigrant connections, but they see the rule of law being attacked over and over and over again, due process being violated.
And you think it's at a scale that lots of Americans might feel it? Because that's always the thing that's hard to tell with this.
Mm-hmm.
You never really get hard numbers. How many people are being picked up exactly? You know, in how many cities, you know? But you believe it's at that scale.
I do. Excuse me. I was on a television program the other day, and Rich Thaw, who runs the Swing Voter Project, was talking to voters in North Carolina. And these are Trump voters, and they are thrilled with what he is doing with immigration. So mm-hmm. from both ends, it's going to have impact. It's going to have impact on those who are upset and those who want to maintain the status quo.
And I want to follow up with that because, you know, Trump has been calling for this biggest deportation, you know, effort in U.S. history, except he pulled back when it comes to immigrants that work on a farm or in hospitality. And at the same time saying target major cities, New York, Chicago on the list. And that we're showing, if you're watching on YouTube, we're showing that post that he made on True Social.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on, he's sort of calibrating though, because this is, you know, he knows that the middle America, a lot of farm workers are immigrants, right? Some of their paperwork may not be together. That could hurt some of his voters. At the same time, his constituents may be okay with targeting big cities like New York, like Chicago. Your thoughts
like
on
Philadelphia.
That? Yeah,
so
like Philadelphia.
When
sure. Exactly.
When you look at what he's doing by pulling back on farm workers or pulling back on restaurant workers, he understands that these people are Americans who are his constituents who are going to vote for him. And so he doesn't want to hurt them, right, in a massive way. I think until people push back It's going to be this mass thing. But I think he will target those industries that are dependent on immigrants, restaurants, hotels, you know, farms, construction, like all of these industries. I think there are going to be exceptions so that those industries can survive, because Americans are not going to do those jobs for the wages that immigrants
do those jobs for.
What
industries are left at this point?
I mean, yeah, there's a bunch there.
Well, I mean, there's about four or five.
Yeah.
And I think that those industries, you're going to see him make some exceptions so that those industries can survive.
Hmm. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And our question of the day is, what do you think is the most significant news story of the last week? And if you're watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming in on the chat. We should bring in another caller. We have Dave from Center City on the line. Dave, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment was, you know, what I noticed this weekend was Center City was empty. The traditional 300,000 to 500,000 Philadelphians that go to the shore every weekend in the summer went, and maybe 100,000 or at most came in. And I think people should look at the real numbers. People just aren't paying attention to this. So I understand it's a story, but I don't think it's the story.
Wait, you're just saying because it wasn't enough people at the protest?
Well, or there was no energy. They were, I'm 60. They were all, I was young, you know, and, you know, it was just a bunch of old people who wanted to march, and they weren't really angry. There wasn't anyone demanding change. They were just saying no king, not, you know, not we got to do this, this, and this. There was no policy. There was no leadership. And like I said, I knew more people who went to the shore than went to the protest.
And were you out there, Dave, by any chance?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I live right on 18th Street, so I mean, it was a short walk for me. But like, once you left the general area, I mean, there was nothing.
Mm.
I mean, it felt small to me.
So that's so. Dave's perspective. Let's bring in another caller who I think was there as well. This is Caroline from Alney. Hey, Caroline, you're on Studio 2. Were you there on Saturday, and what was your perspective?
Yes, I was at the Parkway, and I found it very energizing to be with like-minded people. And there was a lot of young people there. And I think the big story is this Iran-Israel war. And we should all be on the side of Israel. They're taking out a threat, not only to an existential threat to Israel, but an existential threat to the world. And I would like to say, I find it very hypocritical of Christine Flowers to now be opposing Trump when she was such a big supporter of Trump prior to the election. She couldn't see where he was going with immigrants and the way he was anti-immigrant and anti-Hispanic, anti-Mexican. And now she's, where is she now? Is she pro?
Okay, well, let me give her a chance to respond.
All right, Caroline.
So, let's talk about your personal journey on all of this, Christine. So, and people should know your background. You're an immigration attorney, but you're, for a long time, you've been a Republican voter in many elections, not saying exclusively, mm-hmm. right, but you have been. So let's talk about your own, we have a break coming up, but your own personal journey on Trump and where you stand today.
Sure. I am a conservative. I have been a conservative all of my life. I was a Democrat for 37 years and then became a Republican in 2016. I did vote for Trump in 2016, primarily because my big issue has always been abortion rights, pro-life. I'm strongly pro-life and mm-hmm. anti-abortion. But from the very beginning, I've also been very pro-immigrant because I've been practicing immigration law for 30 years. I don't think Caroline has read anything I've written over the past 30 years about immigration, and since Trump was president, pretty much virtually every single one of my columns has criticized anything that I think is damaging to the immigrant community. So I understand what she's saying. I think she's seeing a disconnect here. Someone who could have voted for Trump for other reasons, but who has been a fairly vocal critic of his immigration
policies.
And
that vote was in 2016.
Yeah.
But not 2024.
Nope.
Yep.
Nope.
So we're going to go to a break now. And we heard Caroline also brought up Israel Iran. That's mm-hmm. obviously a huge story from the past week. We could talk about that. We haven't gotten to the military parade or the assassination in Minnesota yet. So I want to make sure we touch on everything. Mm-hmm. Keep your calls coming. Of course, you guys always drive this conversation here at Studio 2. What do you think was the biggest story of the past week, the one that's going to stick with us? And just generally, where are you right now? Where's your vibe?
Feeling?
How are you feeling? 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the YouTube chat. We'll be right back on Studio 2 here on WHYY.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York. That was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And we are continuing our political roundtable discussion, talking about the big stories in the last few days, including the rising resistance against the Trump administration, Trump deploying military in response to protests, to political violence in Minnesota, and so much more.
Let me reintroduce our guest. Christine Flowers is a lawyer and columnist. Christine, great to have you here on Studio 2. Solomon Jones, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist and WURD radio host, a Studio 2 veteran. Great to have both of them with us. And you, of course. What do you think is the most significant news story of the last week? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube. Drop a comment in the chat. And Art, by the way, echoing our last caller, saying mm-hmm. most significant story is the Israel-Iran war that the U.S. will most likely get involved in. That's Art's take. There will be no winners.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a little bit, the politics of it. Israel says its airstrikes on Iranian nuclear sites was a preemptive necessity. And Iran has since made some responsive strikes on major cities in Israel. There have been 200 civilian deaths in Iran, about a dozen plus in Israel. And now foreign leaders are calling for de-escalation. Talk about the politics of all this. How does America look in this, considering we weren't necessarily a part of it? Solomon and Christine, your thoughts.
Well, it's been interesting to watch, because on the one hand, you had America actively involved with negotiations with Iran over its nuclear facilities, and suddenly Israel attacks, and Donald Trump says America knows nothing about it, we don't have any involvement in it, but we tried to stop them from doing it. So which one is it? Did you know and try to stop them, or were you not involved at all? And so that sounds disingenuous to me. It also sounds disingenuous that America somehow told Israel, well, I know you said you wanted to assassinate the supreme leader, but we don't want you to do that. And so Israel pulled back. So again, how can you say you're not involved while at the same time saying you're having these conversations with them? I think it's a very dangerous time. And I'm concerned about America. I'm concerned about my children who are 20 something. I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I think we all should be.
And people are afraid that Iran will now target U.S. military sites and all sorts. Your thoughts on this? I mean, could we get dragged into this war? Do you see that happening, Christine?
I think, you know, Solomon made a good point about the kind of conflicting optics here with the United States and our involvement in this. I remember right after the news broke about Israel's bombardments, and Secretary of State Rubio. And National Security Advisor Marco Rubio came out and said, essentially, we had nothing to do with this. This mm-hmm. was distancing themselves from it. It is very hard, though, to believe that the United States was completely in the dark about what was going to happen. I mean, we are the strongest, most powerful ally of Israel. I will say that Netanyahu seems to, in some ways, do what he wants to do now, even, you know, regardless of what his allies in the international community believe. I also understand why he took the step that he took, because there has been increasing evidence that Iran is upping its nuclear production. You know, query whether or not this would have been happening if the Iran deal that had been agreed to under President Obama had not been dismantled by President Trump in the first administration. So it's incredibly complicated.
Yep.
I am a very strong supporter of Israel. I mm-hmm. have been very vocal, and I stand with them at every level and every point. I am very worried, though, about U.S. involvement in a larger war involving Iran. And I don't know how we would be able to extricate ourselves while at the same time helping our best ally in the Middle East.
And it goes to, where is the Republican Party on all mm-hmm. of this today? Because you mentioned Rubio's sort of rhetorical distancing. There was a time when I think the consensus among Republicans and even a lot of Democrats is that the U.S. should be, ought to be, is proactively involved in all sorts of international affairs. Now, that theory is tilting a bit within the party. There clearly seems to be a tug of war within the Republican caucus about how involved we want to be in any of this, anything, whether it's Russia, Ukraine, whether it's Iran, Israel. Do you have a sense, Christine, of who's winning that tug of war right now?
I don't.
I think it's really tough to tell.
I think it's at a draw, because yeah. I think that there are still the conservative traditional Republicans, not necessarily neocons, but those who always believe that we should have a big imprint in the international community.
The global superpower.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I happen to be a part of that conservative movement.
Yeah.
But there is an increasing isolationist wing of the Republican Party, mostly MAGA, that believes that America first, that we should look at our own interests first, and then
this is a huge test of all of that. It does feel that to me. I don't know.
I think really that there is more of a civil war going on in the Republican Party than there is in the Democrats right now.
And I want to pivot a little bit and talk about the political violence. I mean, and you're talking about Republicans. I mean, President Donald Trump had multiple attacks against him. And political violence. And Matt says the political assassination of a Democratic state representative is alarming. Even more alarming is that if somehow it were the other way around, this administration would use it as a pretext for declaring martial law and suspending habeas corpus. I want to talk about the administration's response a little bit to what happened in Minnesota. Was it enough?
What response?
Yeah,
I just saw a statement. Right. That's all I saw.
That's what it felt like to me.
Well, I will read this in as a mm-hmm. Trump told ABC News, well, it's a terrible thing, referring to the mm-hmm. killing. And he was also responding to the idea that Governor Tim Walz had been on this supposed alleged hit list that the shooter had. Mm-hmm. And Trump said to ABC News, I think he's a terrible governor. I think he's a grossly incompetent person. But I may call him. I may call other people, too. Mm-hmm. You know, this is that is not atypical for Trump to attack a political rival, even at a moment when usually a normal politician would go for a sympathetic
together.
Type mm-hmm. of response.
Yeah.
That said, Trump's done this before. People don't really care at all, at least in the long run. I don't know.
But I think that points to where we are.
Yeah.
Where you have someone whose behavior is so outrageous, so beyond cultural norms, so mean, that people begin to ignore it and feel like, oh, that's just Trump being Trump. No, there has to be a response mm-hmm. to this. Mm-hmm. Elected officials are being gunned down in their homes. There has to be a response, whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. This cannot be, because if you can target them, then you can target other people, too. And so I think that the response is woefully inadequate. I think it's irresponsible, and I think it's wrong. I think you have to respond to this.
And Christine, what are you hearing from Republicans on this? Because I was actually quite surprised that there wasn't a stronger statement, given the attacks that had come against the president
yeah.
when he was on the campaign trail. And now you see actual death yeah. happening. People were murdered in Minnesota. Your thoughts?
Well, I was appalled by the response that the president gave there, particularly since he knows what it's like to be the target of a political attack. Speaking with my friends, they were also quite upset about the tone of that reaction, that response. I know other people who basically sort of brushed it off and said, Trump is trumping. Trump is doing what Trump does. But as Solomon said, that's not enough. You can't stop there and basically say, oh, well, you know, it's business as usual. No, there has to be accountability. And that's the message coming from the top. And the message that comes from the top, it influences and it impacts the people who follow that individual at the top. And they're sort of getting their messaging thinking, well, okay, well, he thinks it's okay to make those kind of comments. It's not. A woman and her husband were gunned down in cold blood. And I honestly think that that is the big story. When we started this discussion today, we talked about what's the big story?
Yeah.
The big story is this passion, this rhetoric, this anger that I have never seen in my 63 years. I'm too young to remember the civil rights movement. My father went down to Hattiesburg, Mississippi in 1967, and he was registering voters, and he dealt with a lot of the violence that I'm sure we all have read about in the history books. But I never had to do that. And I see that same anger bubbling up now. And I'm here to say I am angry at our president for having that kind of a reaction to that kind of a situation and an incident in 2025. There should be more leadership.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, let's bring in another caller now. This is Kimberly from Collingswood, New Jersey, on line three, who I think also has some history to bring us here this hour. Kimberly,
absolutely.
You're on Studio 2.
Hi.
What do you want to add to the conversation?
Last week, I went to Montgomery, Alabama, to the Legacy Project and the Lynch Memorial because I needed to refocus my energy on what I'm fighting about. And the racism and hatred is my issue. I think the immigration issue, the LGBTQ issues, are proxy for dismantling the civil rights movement. I was alive when segregation was legal. I saw the violence. I remember when King was gunned down. But I hear people say, oh, anti-DEI, oh, it's okay, let's get rid of these programs. Those programs are us. DEI is code for Black America. And the hatred and the racism has got to be the focus. We keep following the shiny object. And I think that that's at the core of what... When I got down there was the announcement that Confederate names were going to be returned back to Army bases and the names of vessels that were dedicated to Black Americans erased. We saw the director of the Portrait Gallery at the Smithsonian resign today because the administration, even though she doesn't work for them, said she was too focused on DEI. We saw the Library of Congress librarian, the first Black woman to hold that position, eliminated for some reason that somehow she was determining which books children would read. Black people were fired out of the Pentagon. I get that there are all these other issues, but the core of it to me is how Black Americans have, since our inception, tried to make this country live up to its ideals about democracy. But when we go out there and fight for everybody else, it's assumed that we're supposed to do that. But when we want people to stand behind us, it's always something else. So I was at the march in Collingswood, New Jersey.
Yep.
We had about 3,000 people. I loved that the indivisible leader said, Black Americans have been dealing with us all our lives. This is the first time that we've had to face it.
That's Kimberly from Collingswood,
wow,
New Jersey. And you've written
comments.
Similar things, Solomon.
I have. And I think Kimberly is spot on. I think one of the things that we have to pay attention to is the executive orders. So executive orders really only apply to the federal government, but you see other people saying, oh, well, he wrote an executive order. We've got to do it. We've got to get rid of our DEI program. Well, no, you don't. You're doing that because that's what you wanted to do anyway. And so DEI absolutely is being used as a proxy for Black people. I think that people are being accused of anti-Semitism when that's not exactly what they are engaged in. I think that's being weaponized against people. And I think that immigrants are being used as the out group for everybody else to hate. Your problems are because of them. They put you in this position. They're taking your job. They're making things worse. And so I agree. I think that Black people have stood up in this country in every circumstance, in every war, in every conflict, in every era. And now it's other people's turn. Yeah. Other people invented Donald Trump, and they're the ones who are going to have to get him out.
And before we close out, because we only have a 2.5 minutes before we close the show, but we got to talk about the deployment of military in Los Angeles. Yeah. This display of military during the 250th anniversary of the Army and President Trump's birthday at the same time, and Trump's use of the military. I want your thoughts on that and what you foresee in this as we wrap up. And one of our callers, James from Flemington, New Jersey, wanted to talk about that. So I wanted to bring that up. Your thoughts on this as we get ready to close out the show, Trump's use of the military on domestic soil.
I think it is completely inappropriate. And my question is a simple one. If you didn't call up the military on January 6th, when they were attacking Congress, while they were engaged in the people's business, why are you calling up the military now? I think it's completely inappropriate and very dangerous.
Yeah, your thoughts, Christine?
I diverged from my conservative friends in finding it to be completely inappropriate as well. And my dad was in the Army, and I come from a military family. I have no problem with celebrating the Army and the armed services as often as we possibly can. But seeing tanks rolling through the streets of D.C., that reminded me of Tiananmen Square. So that optic itself really just chilled me, and I think it was inappropriate. And also the cost, you know.
Yeah, sure. It's estimated, there are various estimates out there, $25 to $45 million perhaps for that military parade. Well, we have to wrap up this hour. First, I want to, before I read in a few more comments, just want to thank both of you so much for being here. There was a lot to talk about today. You guys did it ably. Christine Flowers, lawyer and columnist. Solomon Jones, Inquirer columnist and WURD radio host. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thanks.
And oh gosh, what else do we have here?
Few comments.
Paul from Wildwood says, that thing with Trump comes and goes, but what's going on in Israel is very concerning, especially the nuclear threat. Ed said, Trump's now mad and embarrassed that nobody showed up to his dictator parade, and the majority of the country showed how much hatred they have for him. And Brian from New Jersey says, I find it concerning that no one from the administration has condemned the violence against the Minnesota lawmakers. Judith says, Trump has made violence acceptable. So lots of passion today, lots of calls, lots of comments. We deeply appreciate all of it.
For sure.
Let's keep the conversation going, folks.
Definitely. And thank you so much to our producers for putting today together. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Bilzer, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.